Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The CIA hot seat just gets hotter. Attorney General Eric Holder's decision to name a special prosecutor to look at CIA torture of terrorism suspects has stirred a political hornet's nest. Dick Cheney says it's a politically motivated move that will have a devastating effect on national security. Critics on the left say Holder isn't going far enough, and the White House is stuck in the middle. This hour on Point, the CIA versus justice and the controversy over prosecuting torture. You can join the conversation. Do you approve of Attorney General Holder's appointment of a special prosecutor? Are you siding with justice or with the CIA on this divisive issue? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. And joining me first from Washington, D.C. is Mark Mazzetti. He's national security correspondent for The New York Times, and he's been covering this story closely. Hello, Mark, and welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks for having me.
Would you please run us through this again just quickly? The special prosecutor, John Durham, was announced early last week with Attorney General Eric Holder saying that he had no choice but to open this inquiry, given the details in these hundreds of pages that were released after an ACLU request. Just bring us up to date.
The origin of his decision comes from Holder reading the Inspector General's report from 2004, which sort of recounts a number of abuses of detainees in CIA custody. A lot of the cases had already been investigated by the Justice Department, but Holder, after reading it, said that it was his belief that some of these abuses were heinous enough in his mind that they deserved another look, and there was a recommendation from the Justice Department Ethics Office that some of these cases be looked at again. And so it's something that he said over the summer that he was really weighing, but it seems like basically back in July, as soon as he read the Inspector General's report, he decided he was going to have a prosecutor look into these cases, and that's John Durham, who some might remember is already investigating the destruction of interrogation videos in 2005. So Mr. Durham just got busier.
And what were some of the details that Holder referenced, like, say, threats of execution by handgun and drill, for example?
That's right. It should be said that a lot of the 2004 report is still heavily redacted, so it's tough to know what else is in there. But some of the things that were not redacted are cases of interrogators threatening to kill detainees, firing a power drill right near their heads, using a gun to intimidate them, having a mock execution. Those were some of the sort of more extreme details that are in the Inspector General's report, and then some interrogation methods that had not been approved by the Justice Department, that were grasping a detainee's carotid artery until he passes out, that type of thing. It was done multiple times. So there are a lot of details that came out last week about the CIA prisons.
Isn't there also something about the CIA's Office of Medical Services and your own reporting focused on how closely they scrutinize some of the details of this? How many hours spent in a black box? How many calories a detainee would have?
Yeah, it's a very interesting picture that emerges from all these documents. I mean, obviously the focus is on some of the sort of more extreme cases of abuse. But another picture that emerges is of the how closely coordinated the capture and detention of the detainees between Washington, CIA headquarters, the Justice Department, and and interrogators in the field. This was closely monitored. They monitored how often they stayed up at night, the wattage of the bulb in the cells, the number of calories per day that the detainee could consume. It's a very interesting picture of just how closely guarded this program was and monitored.
You know, you just mentioned the wattage in the cells, and the reason I'm concentrating on this is because the rest of the hour we're going to talk about some of the political ramifications of this and what we do as a society about what we are learning. But I think people don't perhaps know all the details that you have reported or that were released in these records. The low wattage, just talk about that a little bit.
Well, one of the more interesting documents that was released last week was a description of the process of detention from the capture of the detainee through their time in CIA detention. So one of the things is they talk about the white noise that is pumped into the cells and into the hallways of the prisons. It can only be, I think it was about below 78 decibels.
Mm-hmm.
Again, these were things that they carefully researched to say that they wanted to make the detainee feel like they were entirely in American hands and to make them feel to some extent impotent, but then not drive the person crazy or, at least create some degree of comfort for the detainees, I guess. The wattage of the bulbs is something that, the cells were lit almost 24 hours a day. So there was then very careful research about, well, how bright could the bulbs be if the cells were going to be illuminated all day. So, it was something that it was carefully researched throughout the life of this program.
But when you say carefully researched, what were they looking at? Weren't they looking at documents from, say, Soviet gulags and what communists had famously done about low wattage or...
Certainly a lot of the actual interrogation methods were derived from... Korean detention and interrogation methods that were then sort of reverse engineered from a training program that the military uses. In terms of the conditions of confinement, they were researching from all different things. For instance, one of the things that they had to sort of carefully detail was the temperature of the water that they used for waterboarding as well as for water dousing, which is another interrogation method. And they looked at some, I think it was Canadian survival literature that talked about, what temperature did water have to be to hit someone before they could be subject to hypothermia.
Mm-hmm. And people confined to boxes, that's something that comes out of one place I know of is Iraq. People locked into boxes where they couldn't stand up or sit down.
Yeah, and seems to be a distinction in the program between a large box when someone and the number of I forget the dimensions of the large box versus the small box and how many hours someone could stay in the small box versus the large box. So, again, these are all details that are stunning in the sense that we have not seen them before, and so that's why this document release was so fascinating.
Mm-hmm. What has the buzz, if you will, in Washington then been? I mean, we know that politicians have certainly taken a stand, but if you could just remind us of that, what's the effect been?
Well, it hasn't necessarily changed a lot of opinions. However, as you referenced earlier, Eric Holder's decision has been criticized to some extent by both the left and the right. Former Vice President Cheney was on the Sunday talk shows this past weekend criticizing the decision, saying it was a political decision, saying that CIA interrogators were operating out of Justice Department authorization. So there's criticism from the right. From the left, there's criticism that Holder has sort of tried to narrowly define this investigation, to have Durham only look at CIA officers who exceeded Justice Department guidelines. What some human rights groups are saying is, well, why limit it to that? Why not also go after the lawyers who approved things like waterboarding? Why not the top White House officials who signed off on these methods? They compare it to Abu Ghraib, where the sort of, low-level people got hung out to dry while the senior people got off scot-free. So, I would contend the difference between Abu Ghraib is that in this case, there really was a whole lot of, as we just talked about, high-level examination of this program and approval of this program.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that's one thing that if certain CIA interrogators and officers are prosecuted. I mean, if I was their defense attorney, certainly that would be one thing you'd bring up, is the level of the top cover that they had in this case.
Right. Well, you talked about the special counsel's office. Daniel B. Levin, a lawyer there, wrote a memo authorizing waterboarding for no more than two sessions of 2 hours a day. But in some cases, there were other authorizations exceeding these so-called recommendations.
Yeah, certainly. One thing that came out this spring when the Justice Department memos were released is that in some of the early days of the program, which was in 2002, Abu Zubaydah, the first CIA detainee, was waterboarded in excess of 100 times, which was more than the Justice Department had allowed. And so you get to this question of at what point is a crime committed? Is it at the moment that they exceed their guidelines? Is it a certain degree beyond that? These are some of the things that the special prosecutor Durham is going to have to figure out. He's also going to have to prove that there was criminal intent, which is a baseline in a criminal prosecution. So these are things that he's going to have to consider going forward.
And we've just got under a minute left, Mark. Is there any sense of when the special prosecutor John Durham might convene this inquiry?
Well, presumably he's starting to gather evidence right away. This is what is called a preliminary inquiry, which they have to determine whether there's cause to go on. I think the general belief is that, usually when the Justice Department launches in the preliminary inquiry, they are going to launch a more sweeping inquiry. So he's already read into the program. He's got top secret clearance, so he can start right away.
Mark Mazzetti is national security correspondent for The New York Times, and he joined me from Washington. Mark, thank you very, very much.
Sure, thanks very much.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the simmering tensions between the CIA and justice over prisoner abuses and the mandate of the special prosecutor. Do you think we should be looking closely or closing the book on past abuses? Or should we be reexamining the very legality of so-called enhanced interrogation techniques? Let's begin by hearing what former Vice President Dick Cheney had to say about this on Fox News Sunday just a few days ago.
The enhanced interrogation techniques were absolutely essential in saving thousands of American lives, in preventing further attacks against the United States, and giving us the intelligence we needed to go find al-Qaeda, to find their camps, to find out how they were being financed. Those interrogations were involved in the arrest of nearly all of the al-Qaeda members that we were able to bring to justice. I think they were directly responsible for the fact that for 8 years we had no further mass casualty attacks against the United States. It was good policy. It was properly carried out. It worked very, very well.
Former Vice President Dick Cheney. Joining us now from Ottawa is Mark Danner. He's a writer and professor at UC Berkeley and Bard College, and he made public the Red Cross report on torture, which led to the Justice Department's disclosure of the CIA memos on prisoner abuse. He's also the author of Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. His new book will be called Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, and War, and it will be published next month. And welcome to On Point, Mark Danner. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Hi, Jackie.
Hello. And also joining us from Washington, D.C. is Reuel Marc Gerecht, a former specialist in the CIA's Directorate of Operations. He's currently a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and an expert on intelligence and terrorism. He wrote an op-ed in the August 29th Wall Street Journal entitled Interrogating the CIA, arguing that new rules and hostile lawyers are returning the agency to a 1990s capacity. Reuel Gerecht, welcome to On Point.
Pleasure.
Well, you both heard just now, I hope, our discussion with Mark Mazzetti, and I'm glad that you're both with us. Would you please respond to what the Vice President said Sunday and has been saying consistently? I mean, this is nothing that he hasn't said before. Mark, why don't you begin, because you did make public the Red Cross report that documented these methods.
The former vice president, as you say, has been making these points steadily since a couple of weeks after President Obama's inauguration. It's a reminder, it seems to me, that the issue of enhanced interrogation or torture and what you call it tends to identify where you are on the issue, that this issue is central to our politics and central to the politics of national security. That is, the former vice president has been arguing not only that using enhanced interrogation techniques was vital to saving American lives, as you heard, but that the new administration, having renounced those techniques, is leaving the country vulnerable to attack. So there are really two parts to the argument. This stuff was necessary, and renouncing it is going to make it more likely that Americans will die in a future terrorist attack. And I think as a political argument, it's been quite effective in putting the Democrats, knocking them back on their heels, as it were. The former vice president has been very aggressive, very articulate, and very willing to get out there every time you have a disclosure of a new document. And those documents have been coming one after the other at a fairly steady rate. So I think his arguments really put in stark relief how this issue has become a kind of political touchstone for our present politics of national security. If you believe that these techniques were necessary and argue strongly for it, you're for a tough approach against terrorism. If you believe that they were a mistake and that they should be investigated and perhaps even people prosecuted, you may be, in this analysis, leaving the country open for another attack. And by extension, you're not serious enough in defending the country against terrorism. So we have here a lot more at issue, I think, than simply the CIA and simply the use of these techniques in the past. It's really about commitment to the war on terror now and whether our politics will continue orbiting around the question of whether you're committed to going after the terrorists. I've been impressed with how strongly the former vice president has spoken and how he's tend to pull the Republican Party behind him. Before the release of these current documents, you had a letter written by six prominent Republican senators urging the administration not to release the document, in particular the Inspector General's report, and arguing in terms very much like Mr. Cheney's that it would weaken the country and destroy morale in the CIA. So this really isn't about just the politics of what was done in the past. It's about the politics of right now. We're, in a sense, having the argument that perhaps we should have had 6 years ago about what the country should do in the war on terror and how much it should compromise, if at all, it should compromise its attachment to international law and human rights. We didn't have it before. These decisions were made secretly. We now seem to be having it 6 years after the fact.
All right. Well, speaking of debate, Reuel Gerecht, you were with the CIA until I think about 1994. You've written this editorial defending these practices and said that the more this gets debated, Republicans have said it's a witch hunt, the more the president's side will lose. But you've also said that perhaps the CIA didn't fully anticipate the extent to which this issue would charge the atmosphere.
Well, I don't know. I think individuals inside of the Directorate of Operations, they now call it the clandestine service, or some do, have certainly understood the possibilities here. And I think that's one reason that you could see in the material that's been so far released a great deal of anxiety as early as 2002 within the Directorate of Operations, because they do realize, they did realize, I think, the political ramifications of this and the possibility that winds could change. So, I mean, I think the president has gotten himself into a bit of a political pickle here by ethical and legal contradiction. At one time, he has described waterboarding, sleep deprivation, and by extension, other enhanced techniques as being torture. Yet at the other hand, he has stated that he didn't want anyone who came within the authorized guidelines to be prosecuted. Now, I think that's a pretty difficult contradiction there. I think that if someone is guilty of torture, then they should be prosecuted. And if they're not guilty of torture, they shouldn't be. So I'm not sure how this is resolved. I think that Fred Hyatt made a good point.
In the Washington Post?
Yes. Made a good point in an op-ed that he'd written where he said that it certainly would be better off if we had some type of truth commission. Now, I would disagree with Fred on some of the moral import he had within that piece, but on the primary point that it would be best if we had a big, large debate on this, and a commission would allow that so everybody could get out there and make their case and really allow the public to decide this, that it would be ultimately a political decision, in the same sense that capital punishment in the United States is ultimately a political decision. I think that would have been the better course. I don't see how this ends well for the administration.
Well, Mark, you yourself have called for a truth commission in the style of the 9/11 commission or commissions around Watergate. Do you think that would have been more effective, and why? Maybe that will still happen?
Well, I certainly think it would have been more effective. I agree with Mr. Garak that this is the grand political pickle of all time. There's a kind of manifest unfairness to the decision, at least what we know about it so far, that the Attorney General has made. In his confirmation hearings, Attorney General Holder said bluntly that he believed waterboarding was illegal. Now he's made a decision essentially that people will not be investigated for having waterboarded because this administration will accept that those who did this did so in good faith, having heard from the Department of Justice under the previous administration that waterboarding was legal. But they will investigate those who went beyond explicit guidelines, which is to say someone who took a drill and revved it up next to a detainee's head, threatened a detainee with a gun, and perhaps waterboarded them using too much water or too frequently or too many times over a certain period. So it's a very strange middle-of-the-road political decision, which, as you pointed out in your introduction, doesn't really please anyone. It also has similarities to the Abu Ghraib decision, in which policymakers were avoided, commanders were avoided, and essentially the people on the ground doing things, much of it, by the way, unsupervised, so it's somewhat different, went to jail, and those who were in control of things did not. So there's a kind of manifest unfairness here that results from really an attempt to kind of walk the middle ground politically. I really do think, to answer your question, that some sort of broad investigation with authority by people respected in the country who could look at this entire program, look at how the decisions were made, look at how the policies were developed, look also at the harvest of intelligence that was gained, because there's no question that a lot of intelligence was gained. The question is, as President Obama has put it a number of times, could this same intelligence have been gained using different techniques, more customary techniques? And to make a judgment like that, you have to look at everything, including the most highly classified material. And I think you have to come out to the public and say, you know, here's the intelligence that was gained. But probably when you weigh it against the political damage that was done to the country, when you weigh it against the difficulties that were presented in prosecuting these people eventually, because they become unprosecutable, many of them. When you look at the damage to the reputation, when you look at the difficulties between bureaucracies within the government, the FBI, for example, wouldn't participate at a certain point in the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah, the first high-value detainee who was subjected to these techniques. When you look at all of these things on balance, this was not a good idea. And the only way you can get a judgment like that, a broad judgment, is really from a panel of respected people who can look at everything and give their opinion to the country. And prosecutions really aren't the way to get information. There are adversary procedures. I know some in the human rights community think that perhaps if these prosecutions begin, they will spread out, possibly because of claims made by the defense that things that seemed not to have been authorized were in fact authorized, that the investigations will spread out and involve policymakers. But I think this is a very dirty, very kind of harmful way, it seems to me, to do this. I think the administration would have been much better advised to put together a group of people, give them 18 months or whatever to look at this in its broad outlines, And then see it reported to the country, because I think Mr. Gerecht is completely right. This is a discussion, a political discussion that the country has to have. It shouldn't simply be carried out by prosecutors prosecuting people who did most likely operate in good faith one way or another.
Thank you. Let's take a call. Richard is calling from East Killingly, Connecticut. Hello, Richard.
Hello, Jackie.
Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. I think Eric Holder has to go to the top of the administration, the top of the food chain, to find out where decisions were made on torture, frankly, on also why the Iraq War took place. The higher up he goes, the more clearing we'll have, and the more honest we'll appear for the rest of the world. We really look incredibly dishonest. If you look back 20, 30 years, you look at the Iran-Contra, where they sold drugs to buy weapons. That kind of stuff is perverse. The savings and loan scandal happened 20 years ago, and now we're doing it again. You have to have a clean sweep. You have to have a clean sweep on this issue and all issues. Otherwise, people will feel cavalier. They'll go into places that they don't belong. They'll do things that commit our children to war.
All right.
And frankly, if we have to sacrifice a few bloated politicians and attorneys and have them pay some kind of price for their action, I'd really appreciate that.
Thanks for your comment, Richard. Rule Gerecht, would you like to respond to Richard?
Well, I suspect that Nancy Pelosi might not like that much. I think if you were to look back, and I'm all in favor of it, of what people knew and when they knew it, you'll find probably a fairly broad consensus among Democrats and Republicans on the propriety of these techniques. It would have behooved the president and the vice president to have a public discussion of this to get everybody down on record, so there couldn't be any backpedaling on this and changing what people knew and what they said. But, you know, that's water under the bridge now. I suspect that the president, President Obama, has no desire whatsoever to have that escalate into that type of event, and he would have a great deal of pressure from elsewhere in the Democratic Party to have that not happen.
Let's take a call from Tom. Tom's calling from Columbus, Georgia. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Jackie. I wanted to speak in support of the interrogation techniques that we use. The reason that I say that is I did 4 years in the military, and I did a tour of duty in Iraq in 2003. We were part of the initial invasion. I was with the 3rd ID. And we were tasked at one point to provide protection for a pediatrics hospital. And we had an individual that came upon us at the end of the day, and he had a grenade in his pocket. And he tried to detonate it against us. Well, he was unsuccessful. We were able to disarm him. And he was subsequently taken away. And I have no clue what happened to him from that point. But I guess my point is that those who think that what we do to these individuals are torture, I think they might want to take a look at what these individuals are willing to do to us. I mean, when a person's willing to strap a bomb to their bodies, or when these terrorists are willing to fly airplanes into buildings, or when they have hostages that they take on their end, and they take drills and they drill holes in their bodies. They found bodies in Iraq with holes that were drilled into their legs, holes that were drilled into their abdomen, and even holes that were drilled into their heads. And we presume that they did that while those individuals were alive. And then, of course, you know, when they're willing to cut someone's head off, and it takes, I don't know if you've seen a video of someone being beheaded, but it takes a good minute to do so. And for most time, that individual is still screaming for their lives while their head's being cut off. And I just don't think that cold water and dim lights and loud noise that we use for interrogation techniques, I just don't call that torture compared to what these individuals are willing to do to us.
I think it goes well beyond those things you just suggested, and I have in fact seen those videos, but I thank you for your call very much, Tom. This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the naming of a special prosecutor to probe alleged prisoner abuses at the hands of CIA operatives and the strained relationship between the agency, the Justice Department, and increasingly, the White House. We're talking this hour with Mark Danner, award-winning writer and professor. He made public the Red Cross report on torture, which led to the Justice Department's disclosure of the CIA memos on prisoner abuses. And we're also joined by Ruhul Gerecht, senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. His recent op-ed in the Wall Street Journal argues that new rules and hostile lawyers are returning the agency to a 1990s capacity. But first, let's go to what has been said politically and recently in Washington. Here's John Kerry on ABC This Week on Sunday defending President Obama's position.
The president himself has been unbelievably bending in the direction of trying to be careful about what happens to national security, protecting our national security interests, being very sensitive about the CIA's prerogatives and needs and so forth. And in fact, I think there's a little bit of a tension between the White House itself and the lawyers and the Justice Department as they see the law and as what their obligation is.
And here is Senator Orrin Hatch on ABC's This Week on Sunday, the same program, talking to George Stephanopoulos, saying the scrutiny of CIA methods is directly harming national security.
Maybe you can question the opinions, but they were sincere opinions. I know the attorneys involved.
Well,
they're wonderful lawyers.
They're not going to be investigating that part.
Well, they shouldn't investigate that part, and nor should they be prosecuting people who acted under good faith following the advice of the lawyers in the department. So, you know, and what they're doing is crippling the CIA, where they're going to be unwilling to really take the risks that have to be taken during really crucial times.
Let's take another call. We're getting a lot. We're joined by Ned. Ned, you're calling from Fisherville, Virginia. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much, Jackie. What a great topic, and it's so important. I'd like to just mention that this is such a divisive and persistent topic. It's been going on for months now. And I'd like to suggest that it's because it's not about torture. It's about the appropriateness of the use of extreme interrogation techniques given the ends that they meet. So it's a means and ends thing. And my position is that it is not appropriate to use extreme measures unless your nation is at war. Now, I know people talk about a war on terror, but we are not at war. We have not been at war since 2003. I would like to remind everyone in this debate that a war is the use of military force against a sovereign nation to compel capitulation and enforceable treaty. If you don't have someone who can sign a treaty and you can enforce a treaty, you do not have a war. What you have is a police action. These measures are not appropriate for police action, nor are killing civilians. I'd like to just hear what some of your commentators have to say about my position. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ned. And yes, Mark?
Yes, sorry, Jackie. Well, that's an interesting position. I have to say that, you know, these things are not supposed to be used in war. The United States is a party to the Convention Against Torture.
The Geneva Conventions.
So they are, in fact, forbidden in war. So I don't find that, I guess, a very convincing argument. I'd also like to say that in relation to the caller before, these techniques, and people should know about them. A lot has been published about them, including the Red Cross report, which you can find on the web. It's 40 pages, very clearly written. And the documents that have just come out from the CIA, the Inspector General's office, basically confirms everything in the earlier Red Cross report. They were quite brutal techniques, including the waterboarding, sleep deprivation up to 180 hours, which is basically a week without sleep, water immersion, other things. So these weren't just slaps on the wrist. They were quite quite brutal techniques. And I think that, you know, this country has a long tradition of going back to the Battle of Trenton under George Washington, of not using these techniques in wartime and adhering to international conventions against them. So the other thing I'd like to point out is it's interesting that we're conceiving this now as a Department of Justice versus CIA argument in Washington. The odd thing is that the decision of the Attorney General, Eric Holder, to only go after people who went beyond the guidelines basically relies on Department of Justice decisions under the Bush administration, which apparently themselves have been questioned in an internal report by the Office of Professional Responsibility from the Department of Justice, which a report that supposedly is going to be released soon. But it's interesting that this administration is relying on their legal decisions, which themselves have been questioned in a report or an investigation begun under the Bush administration. Vice President Cheney over the weekend in his interview complained that now the Obama administration is going after the lawyers, or so he said. In fact, those opinions were already questioned beginning in his administration. The report that questions them and criticizes them and apparently recommends action by state bars and other institutions was actually from the Bush administration itself. So this is rather a complex argument going on right now, in which justice is divided, very much so, and I suspect within the CIA there are very divided opinions about what was done and what should be done.
Okay. Let's take another call. Carl is calling from Watertown, New York. Welcome to the show, Carl.
Hi. I got a question and a comment. One, the question is, we don't hear any comparison to these techniques, to those techniques used by the CIA and Eastern European countries during the Cold War. I'd like to get some comparison information out there. And then second here, as a member of the United States Army Reserve, retired, I just don't think our country stands for torture. And torture, one, should not be used, but neither should we go back and look at what was condoned by the Commander-in-Chief. Should look forward, as candidate Obama suggested.
Okay, thank you, Carl. Rule, what do you think about that? Carl's a former member, is a member of the Army Reserve, and thinks that we should look forward. But he also says we shouldn't be demeaning ourselves by using the other side's tactics.
Well, I don't think we were using the other side's tactics. I mean, the type of treatment that one would receive in the former Soviet Empire is simply so far beyond this, it's not even worthy of comparison. The techniques that were used were largely derived from escape and evasion techniques. The agency has had a long tradition of using them against and training purposes for the clandestine service. When I entered the clandestine service, I was sleep deprived. I was frozen. I was stuffed into small boxes. I was walled. Electronic noise nonstop. Oiled hoods, and a lot more. I did not find any of those things terribly pleasant, and I was quite angry at the individuals who were doing it to me. But I don't think they constituted torture, nor do I think they constitute torture when used against someone like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who killed thousands of Americans and would gladly kill thousands more. I mean, I would agree with Mr. Danner completely that it is immoral and inappropriate to use these techniques in what we would call traditional warfare. It's an entirely different question when you use them against mass casualty terrorists. And that's what we're talking about here.
Let me ask you, you signed up, though, for your mission and volunteered to undergo these techniques, if you will, because it was part of your training. In using them to elicit intelligence, one of the things we haven't discussed is we've agreed that a lot of intelligence was obtained, but nobody can say whether it was obtained because these techniques were used over more traditional methods.
I would agree that the situation is not crystal clear, that certainly what we've now seen in the highly redacted Inspector General's report and what has been released doesn't allow you to say with 100% certainty that these techniques were the only way to go. I'm, however, deeply suspicious of those on the other side who suggest, in an almost Christian way, that with individuals, with holy warriors, that if you take a Christian approach of a father confessor, use it long enough in a nice way, and the people are going to tell you everything that you need to know, and it's all sort of neat and clean, no morality has been violated here. I doubt that. I think most people actually intuitively understand that fear can have a rather healthy effect on one's loquacity. And I suspect that even in traditional acceptable, legally acceptable interrogation, there is certainly an element of coercion and psychological mm-hmm. fear that's, that we try to use. I'm just suggesting that with individuals who would gladly kill themselves and others for the greater glory of God, that these techniques designed for the American marketplace might not be effective.
I want to say that I agree with Mr. Gorek's suspicion about people who simply claim that none of this is necessary and people would talk perfectly easily without any of it. But one should also point out, I think, that those who think these techniques were a terrible mistake and didn't need to be used include a lot of experienced interrogators, including Mr. Ali Soufan of the FBI, who was the first interrogator of Abu Zubaydah and claims he was cooperating before these techniques were used. Jack Clunan, another very, very experienced interrogator, and many other people who are professionals in this. So it isn't simply, human rights workers arguing in the abstract against the professionals who believe that these things are necessary. There's quite a vigorous debate among professionals about it. The other point to make is that one can argue forever, and one is arguing forever, about what constitutes torture, but there is a legal definition. And if you look at the Red Cross report, the Red Cross being the organization that is the legal guardian, as it were, of the Geneva Conventions, it says quite unequivocally, and I'm quoting here, that these techniques singly or in combination amounted to torture and or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. They say this throughout the report in unequivocal terms, and they describe the techniques quite in depth. So whether you think the law should be changed or not is one question, but it seems to me fairly clear if you compare the techniques to what was done, to what the law says, and if you look, ask the Red Cross and other authorities that these things did constitute under current law torture. And it's one of the reasons the Justice Department withdrew these memoranda, I think, at the time they did. So it isn't simply a matter of opinion what constitutes torture.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. Let's take a couple of listener calls here so that we get more people in. Seppo is calling from Augusta, Georgia. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jackie. I just wanted to say I heard another caller bring this up earlier, and it's just kind of a counterpoint is I myself am active duty. I've been through survival schools during my training. I voluntarily had a friend, simulate waterboarding with me just so I could get a matter-of-fact opinion on it practically. I think this doesn't come down to a matter of is it torture, is it not? And, both sides are trying to say it is, it isn't. It comes down to the fact that we're destroying our reputation abroad, and it, one way or the other, and we can't justify it because one side, whether or not they're a sovereign nation or a militia force or terrorists, if they're using dirty tactics, we can't justify ourselves changing our game plan and, torturing, enhanced interrogation, whatever, what have you, what you want to call it. We can't justify using those tactics just because the other side's playing dirty, because in the end, we're going to lose no matter what.
Okay. Thank you very much, Seppo. And Bill is calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Hello, Bill.
Yes, I'm more than a little fed up in wrapping these thugs in red, white, and blue. There's no such thing as torturing in good faith. These people are torturers, period. Waterboarding is torture, period. The first words that should have come out of these people's mouths when they were ordered to do these things was, "No, sir." Period. The idea of, quote, "I was ordered to do it" wasn't any justification during the Nuremberg trials. There's no justification for it now. They should be prosecuted. And that prosecution should go all the way to the top. And if it turns out that you can't prosecute the hack lawyers like John Yeo and take Dick Cheney to the world court, then at least expose what these people did so that they can be held up in future years to the shame that they're entitled to. And prosecuting the underlings would demonstrate to future underlings that if they follow illegal orders, they are not going to be safe from being prosecuted while their superiors are going to go free. That's the lesson that should come out of this entire investigation. I am sick to death of people splitting hairs on what is, whether or not waterboarding is or is not torture, and all the other little devices. This is so sickening.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Bill. We're almost out of time. Rule, do you want to respond to that?
Well, I think, again, that if you go back and you watch the wonderful French documentary that was done of 9/11 and you listen to the bodies falling to the ground and you listen to the telephone calls made of people up in that building knowing that they were going to die, you might have a somewhat different view of this, at least some people would. Again, this issue is about mass casualty terrorism. I think if you save 1,000 lives by waterboarding Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, many of us would say that's a deal.
Isn't that one of the issues, though? We only have about a minute and a half. We really don't know how many lives were.
Well, you don't. I mean, you can, for example, in the 1990s, one could make an argument that the techniques and the tactics used by the agency under the Clinton administration were highly ineffective. If you'd made those arguments in 1997, a lot of people wouldn't have paid any attention to you. Make them in 1998, maybe a few more after you'd had the bombings in Africa. It's really a question of being able to answer this after the fact. Unfortunately, you can't do it at the time. But again, that's why it would be very, very helpful if the administration would release the 3,000 intelligence reports that were collected from high-value detainees, the individuals who were roughly treated.
Thank you. So we could
look at them.
Thank you. Almost out of time. Mark, very quickly, would that change things?
It wouldn't change things, I don't think. You know, at the end of the day, and this is a reflection on what the active duty soldier said a moment ago, this is a strategy of weakness. I saw in Iraq in 2003 our forces surround neighborhoods, basically arrest all the young men, send them to Abu Ghraib, and end up completely clogging our intelligence apparatus there. The interrogators were overwhelmed with the estimate later was that 90% of the people in Abu Ghraib had no intelligence information to give. And, you know, this is sort of giving up our main strength right off the bat.
All right.
It was a mistake, and I think it can be shown to be.
Thank you very much, both of you. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.